This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. We're going to survey the most important news from all over the world this past week, and I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Anthony Chibaderwe.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain.
Good afternoon.
Fantastic job in taking the Trumpet Daily three times this week. You've been a busy man on the radio this week. I really enjoyed listening to you. Maybe we can get a little bit of a rundown of some of what you covered in the programs that you did earlier. But I just wanted to give you the opportunity to start with the top story from Europe this week.
Well, one of the big questions that that you asked me both times I was on this program last week was, how is Germany responding to this call for help from France, this call to arms from France in terms of combating radical Islam? And this week, we got that response. So the first to be announced was that Germany would be sending an extra 650 troops, or up to 650 troops, to Mali. Now, that's a significant number. France has currently around 1,000 troops there. So Germany's going to be able to replace most of France's troops in Mali and really become by far the lead nation, or at least the lead European power in Mali. I think that's the most significant part of Germany's response, but we'll come back to that a bit more later. To give an overview of what else Germany is doing, they're also sending a frigate to the coast off Syria to protect France's aircraft carrier. That's also interesting. They've been fairly willing to send ships and to have naval missions in exactly that part of the Mediterranean before. You may remember about 9-10 years ago, after the UN brokered a peace between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, they put together UNIFIL, the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, and Germany led the maritime task force for UNIFIL. And even with UNIFIL today, they still have a fast patrol boat with them. So their military has been very, or their navy has been very active in that part of the Mediterranean. They're getting back involved there. And then finally, they also pledged support and surveillance help. So they'll have tornado aircraft running reconnaissance over there. They have plans to help France with air-to-air refueling. And then they've also promised to give France access to intelligence from their spy satellites.
Well, how was it that Mali became a focus of attention? This isn't a country that has really been viewed in terms of its producing the Islamic State or refugees or anything else.
Well, on the surface, it is a way Germany can help France out without putting its soldiers right on the very front line.
So it's essentially a matter of replacing French troops, allowing those French troops who've been in Mali to move to hotter hotspots.
That's the surface of it. However, it does get very interesting when you start to dig a little deeper, because this isn't the first time Germany has done exactly that. You may remember, I think it was about a couple of years ago, France decided they need to get military involved within the Central African Republic. And again, Germany said, well, we're not going to put troops on the front line in the Central African Republic, but we will send more troops to Mali for you, and then you can use that to send more troops to, we can replace your troops there, you can send more troops to the Central African Republic. And so they sent a couple of hundred German soldiers to Mali back then. So they've obviously had an interest with Mali for some time. And German Foreign Policy had a fascinating article on their website this week. Unfortunately, it's not in the Trumpet Weekly because it is in German. We haven't got that translated yet, but we absolutely will get some of that material into an article there. And they go through some statements from senior military advisors and from top German military think tanks showing that really Germany has a much more long-term view of Mali. They've been looking at getting more involved in Mali before the Paris attacks. And so this is an opportunity for them to really create a large German base in a very strategic part of Africa. The German Foreign Policy article is called A Ring of Fire in Mali. And they have some material from the Federal College of Security Studies, and that's a government-funded think tank that exists to advise the government. And that was advising Germany to use this deployment to expand its hold on the whole sub-Saharan Africa region. They quoted from the chairman of the German Federal Armed Forces Association, talking about how there was what he called a ring of fire from Afghanistan to Yemen, Syria and Iraq, and to Africa. And he was talking about how Germany can't just focus on Syria. It's got to look at confronting radical Islam across this whole ring of fire. They had some material from the chairman of the Bundeswehr Reservist Association. He's also, I believe, is the head of the CDU parliamentary group on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And he was talking about sending soldiers beyond Mali, about how in the long run, Germany needs to look beyond the borders of Mali. It needs to look at perhaps sending its army into Mali's neighbors. He talked about looking at radical Islam and the flow of weapons in Sudan and Nigeria. He also even talked about, they said that Germany should be thinking about a military mission in Libya. He said, this is a quote, he called for a larger operation that cannot be confined to Mali. So there's a lot of background thinking behind this Mali deployment that goes way beyond just a knee-jerk response to what is happening within France.
Can you just give us a sense of the threat coming from Mali, what it was that caused France to position itself within that country, and how, what, say, Germany's strategic interests would be there in a broader sense?
Right. So northern Mali was a few years ago just an ungovernable zone. People compared it to Afghanistan in that government authority had completely collapsed. It allowed terrorist groups to operate there with impunity. Then that whole border region, kind of in the around the Sahara Desert, the borders are very hard to patrol. There's very strong smuggling networks, and therefore terrorists could kind of use northern Mali as a base and then use that base to strike just about anywhere in North Africa. And they were able to funnel weapons in from Libya, for example, come down to these bases, strike at oil infrastructure in Afghanistan, and it was just a terrorist breeding ground. It was very destabilizing for Mali. It led to Mali asking for help, and that was kind of the initial or the trigger for European involvement. But the much wider context was that Europe has a lot of trade links and a lot of energy links with this whole area, and it needs to protect that area. And so that's what led to the French invasion. But to really paint the broader, or to get a full look at the strategic situation here, you need to look at something that Mr. Fleury, Trumpet editor-in-chief, wrote in the Trumpet a few years back. He wrote an article called Germany's Whirlwind Strategy. And he talked about how Germany was confronting Iran across the world, and really it was surrounding radical Islam sponsored by Iran across North Africa and the Middle East. And it was building bases and getting ready to confront Iran and Iranian-backed radical Islamist groups. And when you compare what he wrote then to what's coming out now from the official German government, it is pretty much exactly the same. Mr. Fleury spoke of a whirlwind, their official think tanks talking about a ring of fire. They're saying we need to use Mali as a base from which we can confront these Islamists. So that the broader strategic picture is really exactly what Mr. Fleury forecast a couple of years ago. And this is a very specific demonstration of that being proved correct.
The response to the Paris attacks, this is really, say, the most overt response, warlike response that Europe has had, but this has been a problem that has been mounting for some years. The recognition of a serious threat by radical Islam from the Middle East, Germany taking steps to try to mitigate against that threat and to contain it, but in a way, this is really just providing them an opportunity to move that effort forward dramatically.
Exactly. Here's just a quote from the Wall Street Journal that backs that up. It says, Germany, which has adopted a largely pacifist stance since the end of World War II, has been reluctant to intervene in the Syria conflict thus far. However, the Paris attacks appear to have shaken parts of the German public out of its anti-war attitude. And then it goes through some of the same statistics, some of the same figures that we talked about last week on this program, showing that Germans are turning around now and becoming less against war.
Well, I'm glad you brought that Gerald Flory article, the Whirlwind Strategy, to our remembrance. He actually taped a program this last week for the Key of David. This will air next week, about just what a turning point the Paris attacks really are. But this is something that we've been watching for. This is really the pillar prophecy of the confrontation between Europe and a radical Islamist power, and watching the way that this is unfolding step by step and preparing for that. It was that prophecy that informed Gerald Flory's article about the Whirlwind Strategy there in Daniel 11. And so watching this take place and reading language like that in the article that you're bringing to our attention really does raise the hairs on the back of the neck of longtime trumpet readers. I'm looking forward to hearing that, reading that article when you get that into print. So I did just want to circle back, and if you could just give us a little bit of a summary of what you covered in your trumpet daily programs that you did this past week, for those listeners who weren't able to hear those.
Yes, certainly. And they were at a little short notice, so I do plan on expanding on some of these themes. We'll probably try and get those written up. But on Monday, I spoke about some of the historic roots of the crisis that we see brewing in Europe right now. So we went back and looked at some of the early days or the origins of Islam, and how Islam arose at this time of a clash of superpowers, really, between Persia and between Rome. Rome figured majorly in geopolitics back then, and a lot of Persia's anti-Rome religious fervor really rubbed off on Islam. And so you get this kind of expression deep in Islamist theology that you see ISIS talking about attacking Rome and about attacking Europe. Then at the same time, on the same program, we talked about the Crusades, about the just really violent response that Europe had to that over really hundreds and hundreds of years. And also how these Crusades unified Europe, how they brought brought Europe and brought the Catholic Church together and really built the Catholic Church as a major power within Europe.
That's an amazing trend. Stephen Flory was talking about that on the Trumpet Daily this morning. Just I forget the source, somebody just saying, will the Paris attacks actually unify Europe? And it's just a very strong trend that's coming out of this that fulfills biblical prophecy in a dramatic way.
Yes, and the next thing we need to watch for with that trend is the Catholic Church getting on board with that. Mm-hmm. But then on Tuesday's program, we talked about space and the final military frontier. There have been a whole number of reports coming out over the past few months about how space is becoming much more militarized. Both Stratfor and the Scientific American had some really dramatic reports about that. So we talked about that. We talked about how China, especially, and other countries are becoming more and more able to shoot down America's satellites, even when they're really, really far out into space, really high up in orbit. They're able to now just about completely threaten America's space-based infrastructure. And we talked about how dependent America is on that infrastructure and how its whole military machine and way of thinking is dependent on having that global positioning system, those spy satellites, that global communication network that comes from dominating space. So we talked about the threat to America there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I really hope that you write that up for the print edition of the magazine. I think just to recognize the Achilles heel within America's military dominance, the ease with which that could be disabled, and the fact that these nations are stepping out and really making strong effort to ensure that that happens, and that they are gunning for the United States in that way, chilling stuff.
It was quite surprising just how vulnerable so much of that infrastructure is. And then yesterday's turned out, I guess, to be a bit more of a like an international relations lecture. We talked about nationalism, or to put it more simply, the love of one's own. We talked a bit about what Mr. Armstrong talked about how mankind loves the empirical self. It loves self, and how things like crises can cause nations cause people to turn inwards, because the best way to ensure that you survive and that your children have a good future is to ensure that your nation survives. If your nation goes down, then your future does not look very good at all. And so when things get bad, when things get worried about the future, they get worried, and people are worried about the survival of their nation, they turn to things like nationalism. They become much more passionate about supporting their ethnic groups. And we talked about some of the same material that we talked about on this program with the Balkans, about how powerful nationalism is, how it could really threaten the roots of Europe and Europe's borders, but also just how it's a very powerful force that, when harnessed, can really have some dramatic results on the world scene. And so we talked about that is the big destabilizing force now unleashed by these Paris attacks and by what attacks will come in the future.
All right, very good. So before we finish with you, I'd like to give you the chance to talk about any other major headlines, the overview from Europe from this past week.
Well, most of these headlines have been driven by the Paris attacks. Attitudes towards borders and immigration are changing fast. There was kind of a dramatic moment in Sweden this week. Sweden used to be pretty much the most pro-immigration country in the world, inviting anybody and everybody in. It was causing huge problems. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, they've been forced to change. The leader of the Green Party, he actually broke down and cried while they were announcing that they were changing direction and that they were going to, you know, limit the rights of people to come to the country, limit the rights of people to bring family members to the country, impose border checks. This leader was crying, but she said that she was completely convinced after the attack that Sweden had to do something, that they had to change. And then Norway was also closing and introducing ID checks on their border. So that's some really open borders in Europe are becoming much more questioned. Switzerland now, women in Switzerland who wear the burqa or the niqab, these are the Islamic garments that only show the eyes or less. Women who wear those will now be hit with a fine, quite a sizable one. I believe it's over 1,000 euros. And that was passed by a 2/3 majority in parliament. And then one thing we mentioned a few times on Trumpet Daily Radio is that Belgium has been on lockdown for about half the week, the entire city at a standstill. People were calling it a war footing. There were soldiers patrolling the streets while restaurants, all public places, schools, universities were all closed. And it was like that for 4 or 5 days. So that was it would transform the capital of Belgium into really a war zone.
Thank you, Richard. You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to transition now to the Middle East. Anthony, let's start with an overview of headlines from the region.
Well, there's a Kuwaiti daily newspaper that reported that Russia has sent ground troops into the Syrian battlefield to support Bashar Assad. That's the Syrian president there. The report has not been substantiated by other sources, but if it is true, this is an unprecedented development in Syria's ground troops on the ground in Syria. And then on Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin made his first visit to Iran in 8 years, and he met up with Iran's supreme leader. And on the same day, Iran's ambassador to Russia said that Russia has already started supplying Iran with the advanced S-300 surface-to-air missiles. And there's another article about the United States Secretary of State John Kerry's visit to Israel on Tuesday, where he met up with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and later on in the day he met with the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. John Kerry, he expressed his sympathy for the Palestinians and said that the United States is committed to the establishment of a Palestinian state. And then last week we saw this report of Iranian volunteer militia who staged 2 days of military drills in Iran, which culminated in a march to a replica of Jerusalem Al-Aqsa Mosque. So these guys are really committed to getting into Jerusalem and taking over.
They're supposed to stop doing that kind of stuff now that they're legitimized part of the rest of the community of nations, aren't they? All right, so your top story for the week, Anthony.
My top story really is tied to just the comments that you just made. It's about Iran. There's an article from The Guardian which says how Paris attacks have strengthened Iran's position over Syria. essentially is just saying that the Paris attack have essentially added more legitimacy to Iran. As you mentioned, Iran has already gained a whole lot of legitimacy with the nuclear deal that was recently signed. The world now looks to Iran as a negotiating partner, but even more now, it's now looking to Iran as a potential partner in fighting against terrorism, especially in the Middle East, and especially following the attacks in Paris. The Islamic State is not an ally to the Iranians. The Islamic State does speak against the Iranians, and Iran is supporting Bashar Assad's regime in Syria, which is being attacked by the Islamic State. So they have come out in public condemning the Islamic State. They've been asking the United States to do more to fight against the Islamic State in Syria. So now you have this attack in Paris, and you now have people saying, you know what, maybe we should have listened to Iran. This article pretty much says the same thing, that Iran has always been making a lot of noise about the Islamic State and saying that we need to do more about the Islamic State. So this development in Paris, this attack in Paris, just adds a whole lot more legitimacy to Iran. There's one expert who mentioned here, he says this, the attack, he says, it in turn legitimizes Iran's military engagement in Syria, which Washington considers as one of the root causes of the emergence of the Islamic State in that country. In that sense, the terrorist attacks in Paris came as manna from heaven for Tehran because of that added legitimacy that Iran now has.
Well, it definitely is amazing how much the Islamic State's advance has really played to Iran's advantage. And for as much as you hear the stories about like what you're talking about, they have people who are marching on a model of Jerusalem and that type of thing. Compared to the Islamic State, they look like quite reasonable fellows. You have somebody going around and doing the kinds of radical things that the Islamic State is doing, and anybody looks moderate by comparison.
Well, a lot of experts who are looking into this, they realize that Iran has been taking advantage of the Islamic State because it's so barbaric, it's so blatant in its attacks. So Iran has been taking advantage of the Islamic State just to use them to distract attention away from Iran, because Iran is busy developing nuclear weapons right now. The Islamic State has absolutely no capability of doing anything close to that. So Iran has been happy to keep its distance away from the Islamic State a little bit, have the Islamic State create all the problems, and now that they've gained the legitimacy that they need, they are now voicing more of their dislike of the Islamic State.
Well, it is interesting how it's been basically used as a partner in its fight against the Islamic State. People are encouraging Iran to step up and to take control of the situation and to move, you know, increase its presence in Syria. Over the whole territory that the Islamic State is taking on. This article that you're talking about that we have in this week's Trumpet Weekly from The Guardian, to this end, Tehran keeps the Islamic State alive as a useful enemy. It really is. It's interesting watching this dynamic unfold here.
Well, I think one of the points that we can't forget about is just how the Islamic State has just absolutely played itself into Iran's hands in the Middle East. Iran now is actually being looked to as a solution to many of these problems. It's seen as a nation that is somewhat stable. It's seen as a nation that has a military that is functional and is useful in the field and can stand up and won't fold in front of ISIS. And the West looks at a lot of these, has an economy that's doing, even despite these sanctions, quite well. And with the sanctions coming off, doing a lot better now. And they're seeing Iran as the most stable factor in that region and as a factor that can actually confront ISIS. And let's not forget that Iran is benefiting greatly in terms of Iraq, too. Iran, power in Iraq has expanded enormously compared to where it has been 3 years ago or 4 years ago before ISIS came on the scene. And also don't forget that ISIS, back in when it was first starting, when it was first getting off the ground, that movement, it received support from Iran as well, because even at that point, it played into Iran's hands. And even if now they are seen as enemies and Iran is not supporting ISIS, actually confronting it, we have to not forget how this really has helped Iran.
And also, you mentioned a lot of the politics, but what I find interesting is that with the Pope visiting Africa, specifically the Central African Republic, there are many experts who are saying that it's a good thing that he's visiting this country, which is in a war between Christians and Muslims. They were saying that's a good thing. But then they were mourning the fact that there isn't a Muslim representative. They were saying it would have been better to have a Muslim along with the Pope, because the Pope is supposedly representing Christians, but there's no one representing Muslims. And that's true on the world stage. There is no one particular country, no one particular entity represents the Muslim world. And Iran is trying to step into that role and be the representative for the Muslims globally, not just the Islamic State.
I think you're absolutely right, Anthony. I think once ISIS has served its purpose, as you mentioned, it's legitimized Iran in the region, and we're seeing it play the same role with Russia in Syria. It's giving excuse for Russia to be in Syria. And once ISIS's usefulness has proven that it's no longer necessary, I think we will see Iran asserting itself in a much stronger way.
We're watching for it. We've been watching for it for a while here. It's amazing. It just continues to roll to this point, the Islamic State. Nobody is really challenging it yet. I was reading some of Churchill's history of World War II, and he just documented all of the points along the way when it would have been possible for any number of nations. France could have done it by itself, checking Germany's power in the lead-up before World War II, and they turned this down, and they let this advantage go, and they let this deadline pass, and they allowed this to happen, and there were so many checkpoints that they crossed on the way to Germany gaining ascendancy and taking over, and it's just interesting to obviously this is going to have a much different outcome, but the fact that the Islamic State is as powerful as it is today is the result of several failures on the part of those who could have done something about it. And you know that Iran is watching the situation closely, because they do have a long-term strategy that they're using, that they're going to ensure that the Islamic State doesn't derail what they're trying to do regionally. Well, these articles that we're talking about, they're in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is our report that we produce each week with the most significant stories from around the world. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you just go online, you can find it on thetrumpet.com and become a Trumpet Weekly subscriber. Coming up, we're going to look at important news from Asia and Anglo-America. And later, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to look now at Asia and Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah, how are you doing? We'll start with the overview.
Okay. Russia and China are working towards integrating their satellite navigation systems in order to challenge the U.S.'s global positioning system, or the GPS that we all so often use. Russia has its GLONASS system, and China has its Beidou. And if the two are integrated, it would bring more than 50 satellites into the constellation. And that would actually be more powerful and more precise than the GPS. Then also on Tuesday, a Russian jet was downed by Turkey. This made really big news, and Russian President Vladimir Putin was really understandably upset by the incident. The Turkish leadership has not apologized for it, and they've also not given any assurances that the culprits of this crime will be punished. So Turkey is a member of NATO, and it has close ties to Europe and some other frameworks as well. So this incident could really serve to just deepen the geopolitical divide that we see emerging between Russia and Europe.
All right, and your top story?
The top story is that the West's memory of the Soviet Union is rapidly fading, and forgetting that dark history is preventing modern people from understanding what Russia's Vladimir Putin is now doing. The story that we've published is called Russia and the Great Forgetting. It's by Ann Applebaum, who spent some time in the Soviet Union in the mid-80s. And Applebaum is just really alarmed by what she sees as a repetition of history now happening with Russia, and the fact that most onlookers just don't have the knowledge of history to understand it. I'll read a quote here from her article. She says, "If you don't know your history, you can't understand what Vladimir Putin is up to. The living memory of the USSR is now truly fading, and the nature of the USSR, its peculiar awfulness, its criminality, its stupidity, is becoming harder and harder to explain. The sense of being surrounded by lies, the underlying anxiety that someone might be listening or reporting on you, the constant screaming, inescapable propaganda, the useful idiots and the cynical sycophants who supported the whole thing both in Russia and abroad, all of that is now absolutely impossible to convey." So it's a powerful article. She goes on after that to discuss the fact that Stalinist architecture is making a big comeback in several Russian cities. She talks about the resurrection of Marxists outside of Russia, guys like Jeremy Corbyn, who is the newly elected leader of the British Labour Party there. But she says that what concerns her more than any of that is the revival with amazing speed of a belligerent Russian state, one led by men who were taught and trained by the Soviet state. And so since these men, such as Putin, were trained under that poisonous Soviet system, they're now prepared to use a familiar blend of terror, deception, and military force to stay in power. And so Applebaum gives the example of the little green men that appeared in the Crimean Peninsula in March of 2014, last year. And that was just after the revolution had toppled Ukraine's president, Yanukovych. And suddenly these little green men appeared everywhere, wielding guns, wearing unmarked uniforms, and just really systematically taking over government buildings. Applebaum says that the Western reaction to that was one of confusion, amazement, consternation. But she says, "I was not surprised. I knew exactly who they were. They were Russian special forces. I knew it because they looked, spoke, and acted exactly like the Soviet special forces, then known as the NKVD, who had entered Poland in 1939, the Baltic states in 1940, and then all of Eastern Europe in 1945. I'll just read another quote here. She says, "During the whole of its existence, the USSR never invaded another country. No, it merely came to the aid of oppressed minorities or fraternal parties. But it never left without imposing, or in Afghanistan trying and failing to impose, its own totalitarian system." And then she goes on, she says, "When the NKVD, which later became known as the KGB, crossed any border, it always arrested political dissidents, looked to take over the media, shut down civic organizations, nationalized companies, and created the fear and poverty." So the Russians, since that Crimean invasion, have used the same tactic in eastern Ukraine. And even before then, they were employing some of the same techniques in Georgia, in Moldova, and in some other areas. And now, adding kind of a twist to the whole narrative, we see Russian forces really coming in strong in Syria, in order to come to the aid of, you know, a fraternal party, which is what Applebaum calls the Assad regime. So not only the United States, but the entire West is just really confused by all of this. And she says it's no wonder, because in the quarter century since the fall of communism, we have forgotten what a cynical, unprincipled, authoritarian Russian regime looks like. And so it's a pretty sobering assessment here. She goes on to say that Russia is run by men who are deeply attached to that old Soviet system. Listeners may remember that President Putin called the collapse of the USSR the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And then by contrast, in the West, you have men and women who thought that the collapse of the USSR just sort of meant that it was finally, you know, they could finally be free to move on and move about other, start to think about, you know, something else. And I'll just read the conclusion to this paragraph or to this article. She says, because those younger than 40 don't remember the USSR, many of them in positions of power and authority and influence are insufficiently inclined to see these same patterns happening now. Because they don't remember the KGB, they are unable to recognize the tactics it has used in the past, and because they don't remember how we undermined the KGB, they aren't yet prepared to resist the KGB, who are once again dedicating themselves to undermining the rules of the civilized world.
That's powerful stuff. It's amazing to listen to that in light of what we've been talking about. Actually, it's the cover story of the Trumpet magazine that we just put out last week. This is our January issue of 2016, where our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, actually details some of the communist incursion into the United States and what it has done to undermine the United States. And you look at the America's response to the communist threat, or you think about it's basically like a punchline. I mean, I remember in the debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, where Mitt Romney was asked who's the greatest threat in the world today. He said Russia, and President Obama criticized him and ridiculed him and said, you know, the Cold War wants its foreign policy back. And the idea of, and we've there's been a lot of information that's come out about just the way that people look at, say, the McCarthy era and the communist threat in the United States, that they went overboard, that they were on a witch hunt, and really ridiculing the idea that communists actually posed a threat. And yet you look at what it has been happening. There's quite a lot of evidence that was absolutely true. In this article that Gerald Fleury wrote, he talks about how basically Richard Nixon single-handedly undermined the threat of communists at the time, and he became a target for them, that was actually what Watergate was about. They were trying to take him out after having exposed Alger Hiss, the Soviet spy who was right there in the middle of the Truman administration. And there's just so many pieces of this puzzle that we're seeing even within the United States. We have this relationship with Cuba now that has developed after we know that the Soviets were trying to get in there in order to attack the United States from this outpost just 90 miles from America's shores. And now here you see Russia just steamrolling with a former KGB agent at the helm who's trying to reconstruct the Soviet empire. All of these folks that should be aware, you know, these points that Anne Applebaum is making, she says that those under 40 don't know it. But look, our leaders in this country, they're products of the system that was infiltrated by communist thinking in so many cases, and they act like we can trust Russia.
Yeah, that's right. It's with those 40 and under, it may be true, you know, just ignorance. They don't know that history because they grew up after it had essentially ended. But there is a willful ignorance, it seems, on the part of some of the older politicians. They just choose to say that was not really a real threat. Like with Corbyn, for example, his conservative opponents have accused him of pushing policies that were last heard in the 1980s. But really, what does that mean to someone who was born in the 1980s or to someone who agreed with those policies, that anti-Americanism, anti-Western sort of sentiment?
And even just understanding what was so poisonous and toxic about the Soviet system, and why did it crash? Why was it such a menace? Why was there so much world opposition to it that caused it to crash? Well, those are all lessons that we've got to remember, lest we go back and make the same mistakes again. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. We're going to move on now to Anglo-America. And Robert Morley, we'll start with an overview.
Sure. NBC Philadelphia is reporting that some families in public housing make over $100,000 per year. The Philadelphia Housing Authority, some officials told NBC about this growing number of high-income families living in public housing. Apparently, there's a 10-year waiting list in Philadelphia to get on subsidized or free government housing. And while there are actual needy families waiting on this list, they've identified at least 181 people that are living on this in these welfare housing projects that are earning more than they're supposed to be. And that doesn't even include a lot of the under-the-table income that many people have. Moving on, reports on Tuesday said that citizens of Syria, Somalia, Eritrea, and Pakistan are among those who are regularly making the lengthy detour through Latin America before entering America's southern border. So the word is out. If you want to get into America, go through America's southern neighbors first, blend in and come across the line. And Ernesto Rodriguez, he's a migration expert actually based in Mexico, and he said that this is a trend that has been accelerating over the past decade. This isn't something that has just happened this year or last year. It's been going ongoing for the last 8-10 years. So there are many people in America that should not be here. Lastly, Australia passed a law on Monday banning parents who don't vaccinate their children from receiving childcare benefit. So the federal government's new no jab, no pay laws go into effect in January of 2016, and they will block rebates, child tax benefits, childcare benefits, the family tax benefit from all parents who refuse to immunize their children. So this is part of this growing movement in the Western world to push for universal immunizations, and we're seeing this in America too, especially in some places like California.
All right, and your top story from Anglo-America.
For the main story today, I want to talk about rising racial tensions at America's college, and specifically the response from a lot of administrators at these colleges. I know this is a topic that you discussed on Wednesday's Trumpet Hour. You mentioned about how students went crazy over the supposed act of racism where they found this bag of poop on the Black College Cultural Center, and it turned out it was a blind student with a seeing eye dog dropping a bag because she didn't know where the garbage is. Well, this week, college administrators at Ohio State Law School went ballistic over a pro-life column that was written in a paper. A second-year law student wrote an article criticizing abortion, and in that article, she talked about the proportionately high abortion rates in the Black community. And she started to get a lot of angry response to this article, like a lot of writers do anytime they write about race-related issues. But then some of that email started getting violent, and she had threats against her. So she filed a complaint with the university asking them to investigate. And what did the university do? Did they go out and investigate? No. Instead, they call her into a meeting with three deans, and she gets reamed out for writing an article that pointed out facts. And then she's told how, after pointing out facts, even if they are facts, she needs to write statements to show how she still supports the Black community in other ways if she's going to point out things that are problems in the Black community. So meanwhile, the threats against her are virtually ignored. And this is what college campuses are becoming today. Administrators are just walking on eggshells. They don't want to do anything that could potentially cause students to riot or for the Black Lives Matter movement to become vocal. They don't want to be called racist and get dragged through the media. But we are starting to see this tension grow, and it is spreading across other colleges. Meanwhile, there's other backlashes growing as well, even from the non-Black Lives movement. I'm rising in opposition today to that. USA Today reported that there are now white student union Facebook pages that are popping up in colleges across countries. You know, many, many colleges have Black student unions where it's student unions just a lot for Black students. Well, now some students feel that if Black students are allowed to have exclusive student unions, then white students should too. Many of these, though, are just anonymous Facebook pages. That's pretty much all that these so-called white student unions are. But there is tension on these campuses. And other news this week, too, related to this, we saw the Black Lives Matter protest in Minneapolis, and we saw those five protesters that were shot. There were five masked men that came to the protest. They were escorted away, and they eventually opened fire, and they hit some people, and some of those offenders were arrested, and it turns out that they were all white. So we're seeing this race in this country really starting to intensify and just become much more friable, and everything just seems like it's sitting on tinder or could be inflamed. It takes so little for things to explode, even greatly out of proportion, as we're seeing in a lot of the college campuses today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that, Robert. You're listening to our Week in Review program, and you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The cover story of this week's edition is about what Robert was just talking about, this racial sensitivity and this tinderbox that's really appearing on the college campuses of the United States. The other stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Anthony.
The United Nations General Assembly adopted six resolutions on Tuesday that all condemn the nation of Israel. Now, it's easy to dismiss this as a relatively unimportant story. Why? Because it happens all the time at the United Nations. It happens all the time. But then it just got a lot more ridiculous because five of those resolutions were sponsored by the Palestinian Authority. And the sixth one was sponsored by Syria. And one of those resolutions demand that Israel give up the Golan Heights and give it to Syria. And Syria is a country that's ravaged by 4 years of civil war. So they want Israel to give up the Golan Heights, to give it up to Syria. So if they do that, it would likely be overrun by the Islamic State. So this is something that's coming from the United Nations General Assembly. It's just ridiculous.
This is how they respond to terrorist attacks in Paris, by condemning Israel, I guess, huh? All right, moving on to Richard.
I'd like to cover a few articles about France's crackdown on civil liberties. And we have an article from the New York Times in the Trumpet Weekly that notes that all over France, it says from Toulouse to the south of Paris and beyond, the police have been breaking down doors, conducting searches without warrants, aggressively questioning residents, hauling suspects to police stations and putting others under house arrest. And it says these are all legal under the state of emergency that has now been extended for 3 months. And we saw that extension come through over the past week or so. And they continue to write that this was an indication of the lingering shocks of the attacks and the fear coursing through French society. The Economist, we don't actually have this one in the Trumpet Weekly, but it made a similar point about how this is a socialist government putting in place what was, it says, previously the preserve of political right. And it says the civil liberties left has become inaudible. In one poll, 84% of French said they would be prepared to accept further constraints on freedom. Brutally shaken by the terrorist attack on the French way of life, the country seems ready to recalibrate its balance of civil liberties and national security. Now, my main point here is just to look how much France has been shaken by these attacks. And I don't think it's necessarily wrong to reduce civil liberties in a time of war. Both Churchill and Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, for example. But the fact that the French are acting this way shows how seriously and how much fear there is at this situation. But then beyond that, I think knowing Europe's history and in the grand sweep of Europe's history, civil liberties have been very rare. You do have to worry now about the direction Europe is going to take after this attack. And are we going to see much more clampdown on civil liberties? And I think we definitely are. And I think we certainly are when it comes to civil liberties for Muslims, for example.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We'll move on now to Jeremiah.
Well, China said on Sunday that it will continue to build military facilities on its artificial islands in the disputed South China Sea. Beijing said despite some chiding and some finger-wagging from the United States, it will just carry on with these provocative activities. Listeners may remember that many of these artificial islands that China is militarizing are as far as 800 miles from Chinese territory, and international law places these far outside of China's actual jurisdiction, and in some cases well within the jurisdiction of other nations such as the Philippines. But that is international law, which is really a fiction. The concept of international law would require an authority to enforce it. The United Nations sometimes pretends to be that authority. The United States sort of used to be that authority, working towards enforcing international law. But now, as the United States retreats, nations like China see that they can just essentially do what they want. They have the power, and they know that no one will really stop them. So I think that we can expect to see more and bigger pushes by China and other such nations in the months ahead.
Thank you, Jeremiah. And on to Robert.
Well, the Islamic State is radicalizing thousands of people in the United States, according to a new report, and it's raising concerns that supporters of this terrorist group could, even now as we speak, be plotting domestic terror attacks. The Threat Knowledge Group is an organization that's led by counterterrorism experts, and it has compiled a list of 82 individuals in the United States that were affiliated with the Islamic State and have so far been apprehended by law enforcement officials, including those who have traveled to Iraq and Syria and back, some who have even launched domestic attacks and failed, or are participating in recruiting and fundraising. And this report goes on to say that almost a third of the individuals had actually plotted attacks against Americans on U.S. soil in the last year and a half. And this is just one quote from their report. They said, based on the evidence available, the number of ISIS supporters in the United States measures in the thousands rather than in the hundreds. And basically they say that a Paris-type attack is most likely coming to America. So here we are pushing ahead with our immigration policies. Officials know that these radicals are in America and more are coming through, and yet we continue on.
Yeah, we were talking about that, Anthony and I were talking about that on Wednesday, just how high the percentages are among the states. I think it was 11 nations, mostly in the Middle East, representing millions of people that are supportive of ISIS. I wanted to finish with just talking about a video that emerged this past week from the Islamic State's Al-Hayat Media Center. They released a recruitment video, and it's quite chilling to watch, especially in light of events and statistics like what you're talking about there, Robert. It's a very high-quality video, high-definition, crisp 1080p production, just over 4 minutes. It's in English. It's aimed at English-speaking recruits. It aims to draw a dramatic distinction between the corrupt West and the noble, theologically pure Islamic State. Most of the video is directed against the United States. It calls American politicians liars and fornicators, with prominent pictures of George W. Bush and Bill Clinton as they use those words, and it criticizes the U.S., saying that our soldiers fight for the freedom of sodomites. It says, America, you claim to have the greatest army history has known. You may have the numbers and weapons, but your soldiers lack the will and resolve. Still scarred from their defeats in Afghanistan and Iraq, they return dead or suicidal, with over 6,500 of them killing themselves each year. So while you go around cooking the facts on the results of your military airstrikes, we continue to haunt the minds of your soldiers and sow fear into their hearts, with 18 of your soldiers committing suicide each day before you've even advanced. The video mocks the fact that we don't put boots on the ground, that we fight from the air, that we fight with $250,000 bombs while they shoot us with 50-cent bullets. It's pretty chilling stuff. You know, the White House says that when the U.S. is strong against Muslims, that's a recruiting tool for the Islamic State. Well, actually, here's the recruiting tool. It's American hypocrisy. It's the sins that America is committing. It's the curses that America is suffering. And what's really amazing, by the end of this video, they're challenging Russia and Iran and France and literally every country on earth. The video shows flags from basically every country on earth. And it says, so bring it on, all of you. Your numbers only increase us in faith. Bring it on. It says, our ally is the greatest. He is Allah, and all glory belongs to him. So these folks want war. And it's pretty clear that the only thing that's going to stop them is war. That's what we have to look forward to here. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories we've talked about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Just email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chabadewe, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Jim Elliot. Wherever you are, be all there. Live to the hilt every situation you believe to be the will of God. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.